tight black ball, with just a crest of distinctive white. Only it wasn't all white. There was deep red there, too. Frasimon threw his gardening tools to the ground and leaped forward, wading through the bushes to get there, stomping on his precious perennials, killing the cheerful black-eyed Susan standing in his way. A monk, one of his brothers, was hurt, badly hurt.
"I thought,"
said Frasimon, not looking into Gamache's eyes, but down at the rosary in his hands. His voice was low, not above a whisper, and the chief leaned forward to grasp each rare word.
"I thought—"
Now Frasimon did look up. The memory alone was enough to frighten him. Gamache said nothing. He kept his face neutral, interested. But his deep brown eyes never left the monk's.
"I thought it was Dom Philippe."
His eyes fell to the simple cross swinging from his rosary. Then Frasimon brought his hands up and dropped his head and held it there, so that the cross knocked softly against the monk's forehead, and then stopped.
"Oh, God, I thought he was dead. I thought something had happened to him."
Frère Simon's voice was muffled, but while his words were obscured, his feelings couldn't have been clearer.
"What did you do?" asked Gamache softly.
His head still in his hands, the monk spoke to the floor.
"I hesitated. God help me, I hesitated."
He lifted his head to look at Gamache, his confessor, hoping for understanding, if not absolution.
"Go on," said Gamache, his eyes never wavering.
"I didn't want to see. I was afraid."
"Of course you were. Anyone would be. But you did go to him, finally," said the chief. "You didn't run away."
"No."
"What happened?"
Now Frère Simon held on to Gamache's eyes as though they were a rope and he was dangling from a cliff.
"I knelt and turned him a little. I thought maybe he'd fallen from the wall or the tree. I know it's ridiculous, but I couldn't see how else it could have happened. And if he'd broken his neck, I didn't want to—"
"Oui," said Gamache. "Go on."
"Then I saw who it was."
The monk's voice had changed. It was still filled with stress, with anxiety, reliving those terrible moments, but the degree had changed.
"It wasn't the abbot."
There was clearly relief.
"It was the prior."
And even more relief. What had started as a dreadful tragedy had ended as almost good news. Frère Simon couldn't hide it, or chose not to. Still he held the chief's gaze, searching it for disapproval. He found none, only acceptance that what he was hearing was almost certainly, finally, the truth.
"Was he alive?" Gamache asked.
"Oui. His eyes were open. He stared at me and grabbed my hand. You're right. He knew he was dying. And I knew. I couldn't tell you how I knew, but I did. I couldn't just leave him."
"How long did it take?"
Frère Simon paused. It had obviously taken an eternity, kneeling in the earth, holding the bloody hand of a dying man, a fellow monk, a man this man despised. "I don't know. A minute, maybe slightly more. I gave him last rites, and it calmed him a bit."
"What are the last rites? Can you repeat them for me?"
"Surely you've heard them." Gamache had heard them, and knew them, had given them himself, swiftly, urgently, while holding one dying agent after another. But he wanted Frère Simon to say them now. Simon closed his eyes. His right hand reached out just a little, and cupped just a little, holding an invisible hand. "O Lord Jesus Christ, most merciful Lord of earth, we ask that you receive this child into your arms, that he might pass in safety from this crisis, as thou hast told us with infinite compassion."
His eyes still closed, for as Simon lifted his other hand, and with his thumb he sketched a cross, on the dying monk's forehead.
"Infinite compassion," thought Gamache, looking down at the young agent, his own spectre in his own arms. In the heat of the moment, Gamache hadn't had time to give the full last rites, so he'd simply bent down and whispered, "Take this child." But the agent was already gone, and Gamache himself had to go.
"This is where," the chief said, "a dying man, if he's able, gives his confession."
Frère Simon was silent.
What did he say? Gamache asked.
He made a noise, said Frère Simon, as though in a trance, trying to clear his throat, and then he said, Homo. Now Simon focused. He came back from far away. The two men stared at each other.
Homo? Asked the chief.
Frère Simon nodded. You can see why I didn't say anything. It has nothing to do with his death.
But, thought Gamache, perhaps a lot to do with his life.
The chief considered for a moment.
What do you think he meant? He finally asked.
I think we both know what he meant.
Was he gay? Homosexual?
For a moment, Frère Simon tried on his disapproving look, then abandoned it. They were far beyond that.
It's hard to explain, said Frère Simon. We're 2 dozen men here alone. Our goal, our prayer, is to find divine love, compassion, to be consumed by the love of God.
That's the ideal, said Gamache. But in the meantime, you're also human.
The need for physical comfort was, he knew, powerful and primal, and didn't necessarily go away with a vow of chastity.
But what we need isn't physical love, said Frère Simon, correctly interpreting Gamache's thoughts and correcting him.
The monk didn't sound at all defensive. He was simply struggling to find the right words.
I think most, if not all of us, have left that far behind. We're not highly sexed or sexual.
What do you need, then?
Kindness, intimacy, not sexual, but companionship. God should replace man in our affections, but the reality is we all want a friend.
Is that how you feel with the abbot?
Gamache asked the question boldly, but his voice and manner were gentle.
I saw how you reacted when you thought he was the one hurt and dying.
I love him, it's true, but I have no desire for physical relations. It's hard to explain a love that goes so far beyond that.
And the prior, did he love another?
Frère Simon was silent, not a mulish silence, but a contemplative one. After a minute or so he spoke.
I wondered if he and the abbot— It was as far as he could go for the moment.
There was another pause.
There were many years when they were inseparable. Besides myself, the prior was the only other person ever invited into the abbot's garden.
For the first time, Gamache began to wonder if the garden existed on different planes. It was both a place of grass and earth and flowers, but also an allegory, for that most private place inside each one of them. For some it was a dark, locked room, for others a garden. The secretary had been admitted, and so had the prior. And the prior had died there.
What do you think the prior meant? Asked Gamache.
I think there's only one possible interpretation. He knew he was dying, and he wanted absolution.
For being a homosexual? I thought you just said he probably wasn't.
I don't know what to think anymore. His relationships might have been platonic, but he might have privately yearned for more. He knew it, and God knew it.
Is it the sort of thing God would condemn him for? Gamache asked.
For being gay? Maybe not. For breaking his vow of chastity, probably. It's the sort of thing that would need to be confessed.
By saying homo?
Gamache was far from convinced, though when a person was dying, reason played a very small part, if any. When the end came and there was time for only one word, what would that be? The chief inspector had no doubt what his last words would be, and were. When he thought he was dying, he'd said 2 words, over and over, until he could speak no more.
Oine Marie.
It would never occur to him to say hetero, but then he carried no guilt about his relationships, and maybe the prior did.
Do you have his personal records, I might see? Asked Gamache.
No.
No, you don't want to show me, or no, you really don't have files.
We really don't have files.
On seeing the chief inspector's expression, Frère Simon explained. When we enter the religious life, we're rigorously tested and screened, and our first abbey would have kept records. But not Dom Philippe, not here at Saint-Gilbert.
Why not?
Because it can't possibly matter.
We're like the French Foreign Legion. We leave the past behind.
Gamache stared at this religieux. Was he really that naive?
Just because you want to leave your past at the gate doesn't mean it stays there, said the chief. It has a way of creeping through the cracks.
If it comes all this way, then I suppose it was meant to find us again, said Frayssimon.
By this logic, thought Gamache, the prior's death was also God's will, meant to happen. God clearly had his hands full with the Gilbertine, the French Foreign Legion of religious orders. It fit, Gamache thought. No retreat was possible. There was no past to go back to, nothing outside the walls but wilderness.
Speaking of cracks, do you know about the foundations? Gamache asked.
The foundations of what?
The abbey.
Frayssimon looked confused.
You need to speak to Frère Raymond about them, but give yourself half a day and be prepared to come away knowing more about our septic system than is probably healthy.
So the abbot didn't say anything to you about the foundations of the abbey? And the prior didn't either?
Now it dawned on Frayssimon.
Is there something wrong with them?
I was asking if you'd heard anything.
No, nothing. Should I have?
So the abbot had kept it to himself, as Gamache had suspected. Only the abbot and Frère Raymond knew that Saint-Gilbert was crumbling, had, at best, a decade of life left. And maybe the prior also knew. Maybe Frère Raymond, in desperation, had told him. If so, the prior had died before he could tell anyone else. Was that the motive? To shut him up?
Will no one rid me of this troublesome priest?
You knew the prior had been murdered, didn't you?
Frayssimon nodded.
When did you realize?
When I saw his head and...
The monk's voice petered out. Gamache stayed completely quiet, waiting.
And then I saw something in the flower bed, something that shouldn't be there.
Gamache stopped breathing. The two men became a tableau vivant, frozen in time. Gamache waited, and waited. His breathing now was shallow, quiet, not wanting to even disturb the air around them.
It wasn't a stone, you know.
I know, said the chief.
What did you do with it?
He almost closed his eyes to pray that this monk hadn't picked it up and thrown it over the wall, to disappear back into the world.
Frayssimon got up, opened the main door into the abbot's office, and stepped into the corridor.
Gamache followed, presuming the monk was leading him to some hiding place. But instead, Frayssimon stopped at the threshold and reached over, then presented Chief Inspector Gamache with the murder weapon. It was the old iron rod used for hundreds of years to gain admittance to the abbot's most private rooms, and used yesterday to crush the skull of the prior of Saint-Gilbert entre les loups.
Chapter 25. Jean Guy Beauvoir coursed through the corridors of Saint-Gilbert entre les loups, searching. The monks who ran into him initially paused to greet him with their customary bow, but as he got closer they stepped back, out of his way, and were relieved when he passed them by. Jean Guy Beauvoir stalked the corridors of the monastery, looking in the vegetable garden, looking in the animalerie with the grazing goats and Chanticleer chickens, looking in the basement, where Frère Raymond was invisible but his voice echoed down the long, cool corridors. He was singing a chant. The words were slurred, and his voice, while still beautiful, held little of the divine and more of the brandy and Benedictine. Beauvoir raced back up the stone stairs and stood in the blessed chapel, breathing heavily, turning this way and that. Monks in their long black robes stood away from the dancing light, watching him. But he paid no attention. They weren't his quarry. He was hunting someone else. Then he turned and pushed his way through the closed door. The hallway was empty, and the door at the end was closed and locked.
"Open it," he demanded.
Frère Luc didn't dawdle. The massive key was in the lock and turned, the deadbolt thrust back, and the door open within moments. And Beauvoir, robed in black as surely as if he'd been wearing a cassock, was out the door. Luke closed it quickly. He was tempted to open the slot in the door and look out,
to watch what was about to happen. But he didn't. Frère Luc didn't want to see or hear or know. He went back to his little room and put the big book on his knees and lost himself in the chants. Beauvoir saw what he was looking for immediately, standing by the shore. Not thinking, not caring, he was miles beyond either. Beauvoir ran with all his might. Ran as though his life depended on it. Ran as though lives depended on it. Straight at the man in the mist. As he ran, he let out a terrible sound from deep in his belly. A sound he'd kept in for months and months. A sound he'd swallowed and hid and locked away. But now it was out, and propelling him forward. Chief Superintendent Francois turned just moments before Beauvoir crashed into him. He took half a step away, avoiding the brunt of the blow. Both men fell to the rocks, but Francois not as heavily as Beauvoir. He scrambled out from underneath Beauvoir and reached for his gun, just as Beauvoir rolled over and sprang to his feet, also reaching for his weapon. But it was too late. Francois had his gun out and aimed at Beauvoir's chest.
"You shithead!" Beauvoir screamed, barely noticing the weapon. "You fucker! I'll kill you!"
"You just attacked a superior officer," snapped Francois, shaken.
"I attacked an asshole and I'll do it again."
Beauvoir was yelling at the top of his lungs, shrieking at the man.
"What the hell is this about?"
Francois yelled back.
"You know damn well. I found what you had on the laptop, what you were looking at when I came in."
"Oh, fuck," said Francois, looking at Beauvoir with uncertainty. "Did Gamache see it?"
"What the hell does that matter?"
screamed Beauvoir. Then he bent over, hands on his knees, trying to catch his breath. He looked up.
"I saw it."
Deep breath in, he begged his body. Deep breath out. "Christ, don't pass out." Deep breath in, deep breath out. He felt light-headed. "Oh, dear God, don't let me pass out now." Beauvoir released his knees and slowly straightened. He'd never be as tall as the man opposite, the man with the gun pointed at Beauvoir's chest. But Beauvoir stood as tall as he could and stared at the creature.
"You leaked the video."
His voice had changed. It was raspy, insubstantial. Each word rode out of his mouth on a deep, deep breath from deep, deep down. The door to his private place had blown off, and with it came the words and the intent. He would kill Francois. Now. Beauvoir kept his eyes locked on the superintendent. In the blurry edge of vision, he could see the gun. And he knew, when he leaped, Francois would get off at least two shots, before Beauvoir covered the space between them. And Beauvoir calculated that as long as he wasn't hit in the head or the heart, he'd make it there, and have just enough life left, enough will, to tackle this man to the ground, grab a rock, and crush his skull. He was reminded, for a mad moment, of the story his father had read to him over and over, about the train. "I think I can. I think I can. I think I can kill Francois before he kills me." Though Beauvoir knew he'd die too, just not first. Dear God, not first. He tensed and leaned forward a fraction, but Francois, hyper-alert, raised the gun a fraction, and Beauvoir stopped. He would bide his time, wait for that split second of distraction on Francois's part. "That's all I need. I think I can. I think I can."
"What?"
the superintendent demanded.
"You think I leaked the video?" "Stop the fucking games. You betrayed my friends, your own people. They died."
Beauvoir felt himself slipping into hysteria, nearly sobbing, and hauled himself back.
"They died and you leaked a fucking tape of it happening."
Beauvoir's throat was closing in, his voice just a squeal. His breathing came in wheezes as he hauled air through the shrinking passage.
"You turned what happened into a circus, you...
He could go no further. He was overwhelmed by images of the raid on the factory, of Gamache leading them, of the Sûreté officers surging in, following their leader, to save the kidnapped officer, to stop the gunman. Jean-Guy Beauvoir stood on the quiet shore and could hear the explosions of gunfire, hear the bullets strike the concrete, the floors, the walls, his friends. He could smell the acrid smoke mixed with concrete dust, and he felt his heart pound with adrenaline and fear. But still he'd followed Gamache, deeper and deeper into the factory. They'd all followed Gamache. The raid had been captured on the cameras attached to each agent's headgear. And later, months later, it had been hacked and edited and released onto the internet. Beauvoir had become as addicted to that video as he had to painkillers. Two halves of a whole. First the pain, then the killers. Over and over and over, until it had become his life, watching his friends die. Over and over and over. But one question remained. Who had leaked that video? Beauvoir knew it was an inside job, and now he had his answer. Now all he wanted was to stay conscious long enough to kill the man in front of him, for betraying his own people, Gamache's agent, Beauvoir's friends. To lose them was bad enough, but to have the tape of the attack released onto the internet, for millions and millions worldwide to see, for all of Quebec to see. And they had. Everyone had grabbed their popcorn and watched, over and over, as the Sûreté officers had been gunned down in that factory. They watched, as though the deaths were entertainment. And the families of the slain had seen it, too. It had become an internet sensation, replacing the box of kittens as the most-watched video. Beauvoir stared into Francais's eyes. He didn't need to look at the gun. He knew it was there. And he knew what it would feel like, any moment now, when the first bullet hit. He'd felt it before, the thud, the shock, then the searing pain. He'd seen so many war movies, so many westerns. He'd seen so many bodies, real ones, shot to death. He'd somehow fooled himself into thinking he knew what it would be like, to be shot. He'd been wrong. It wasn't just the pain, it was the terror, the blood, the frantic scrambling to get at the burning, but the hurt was too deep. That had been less than a year ago. It had taken him a long time to recover. Longer than the chief. Gamache had thrown himself headlong into recovery, into the physiotherapy, into the weights, the walking, the exercises, the counselling. Beauvoir knew that every sight, every scent, every sound that the chief took in was keener now. It was as though he was living for five, himself and four young agents. It had somehow invigorated the chief. But the attack, the losses, had had the opposite effect on Beauvoir. He'd tried, he really had, but the pain seemed too deep, and the agony too great, and the painkillers too effective. And then the video had appeared, and the pain sizzled again, burning even deeper, and more painkillers were needed, and more, to dull the hurt and the memories. Until finally the chief had intervened. Gamache had saved him that day in the factory, and had saved him again months later when he'd insisted Beauvoir get help, for the pills and for the images that had wormed into his head, forcing him to go into intense therapy, into rehab, forcing him to stop running and turn and face what had happened. Gamache had also forced a promise from him to never again watch that video. And Beauvoir had kept his promise.
"They'd give anything to be here now," Gamache had said one day in the spring, as he and Beauvoir strolled through the park across from the Gamache's apartment in Outremont. Beauvoir knew who the chief meant. He could see Gamache taking everything in, as though to share it with his dead agent. The chief had stopped then to admire a massive old lilac bush in full bloom. Then he turned to Beauvoir. "It's against the law to pick them, you know. Only if you get caught." Beauvoir moved to the other side of the bush and saw it shaking, as though with laughter, as Gamache tugged the spiky, fragrant flowers off. "An interesting take on justice," called the chief. "It's only wrong if you're caught." "Would you prefer me to arrest you?" Beauvoir yanked some more flowers off. He heard the chief laugh. Beauvoir knew the burden the chief now carried, to live for so many. Gamache had staggered at first, but had finally grown stronger under that weight. And Beauvoir felt better every day he was clean, away from the drugs, and away from the hair shirt of images he'd inflicted on himself. The chief had given Madame Gamache's bouquet of stolen lilacs, and she'd put them in a white jug and placed them on the table. Then she'd put Beauvoir's smaller bouquet in water so they'd stay fresh to take back home after dinner. But, of course, they didn't make it to his own small apartment. He'd given them to Annie.
They'd just started their courtship, and it was the first flowers he'd offered. "Stolen," he admitted, as she'd opened the door and he'd held them out to her. "Your father's influence, I'm afraid."
"It's not the only thing you've stolen, monsieur," she'd said with a laugh, stepping aside to let him in.
It had taken him a moment to realize what she meant. He watched her place the lilacs in a vase on her kitchen table and fluff them a bit, trying to arrange them. He'd stayed the night, for the first time, and woke in the morning to the suggestion of lilac and the realization that he had Annie's heart in his chest, and she had his, and would keep it safe. Beauvoir had kept his promise to Annie's father, to the chief, to not watch that video again. Until now. Until he'd found out what Superintendent Francois had been doing in the prior's office, on the laptop. Francois had brought the video with him, and was watching it. Those were the voices Beauvoir had heard, the chief's issuing orders, commanding, leading his agent deeper and deeper into that damned factory, after the gunman. Beauvoir had found the file on the laptop. As he'd hit play, he'd known what he'd see. And, God help him, he'd wanted to see it again. He'd missed his misery. Beauvoir stared at Francois in front of him on the misty shore. He'd brought that monstrosity into the monastery, to contaminate the last place in Quebec, the last place on earth that hadn't seen the images. And Beauvoir knew, at that moment, why, despite the strangeness of the surroundings, the oddity of the monks, the mind-numbing dullness of the endless chants, he'd felt a kind of creeping calm here. Because these men, unique in Quebec, didn't know, hadn't seen the video, didn't look at him and Gamache as though at men forever wounded, damaged. Instead, the monks looked at them as though they were just men, like themselves, going about their jobs. But Francois had fallen from the skies and brought this blight. But it would stop here, now. This man had done enough damage, to Gamache, to Beauvoir, to the memories of those who died and their families.
"You think I leaked that video?" Francois repeated.
"I know you did," gasped Beauvoir. "Who else had access to the raw tape? Who else could influence that internal investigation? An entire Sûreté department devoted to cybercrime, and all they came up with was that some unknown hacker had gotten lucky?"
"You don't believe it?" asked Francois.
"Of course I don't."
Beauvoir moved, but stopped when Francois jutted his gun forward. There'd be a better time, thought Beauvoir, in a moment or two, when Francois was distracted. Just a blink, that's all it'll take.
"Does Gamache believe it? The hacker theory?"
For the first time, Beauvoir was thrown off.
"I don't know." "Of course you know, you little shit. Tell me, does Gamache believe it?"
Beauvoir said nothing, just stared at Francois, his mind taken up with only one question. Was now the time?
"Is Gamache investigating the leak?" Francois yelled. "Or has he accepted the official report? I need to know."
"Why? So you can kill him too?"
"Kill him?" Francois demanded. "Who do you think released that video?"
"You."
"Christ, you really are sick. Why do you think I brought it with me? To enjoy my handiwork? The thing's repulsive. It makes me sick just thinking about it. Watching it is—"
Francois was trembling now, almost erupting with rage.
"Of course I don't believe the findings of that goddamned investigation. It's ridiculous. Obviously a cover-up. Someone inside the Sûreté leaked the video, not some mythical hacker. One of us. I brought that fucking tape with me because I watch it every chance I get, so I don't forget, so that I remember why I'm still looking."
His voice had changed. The accent grew thicker. The sophistication fell off in hunks to reveal the man who'd grown up in a village away from Beauvoir's own grandparents. Francois had lowered the nozzle of his gun, just a fraction. Beauvoir saw this. Francois was distracted. Now was the time. But he hesitated. "What are you looking for?" Beauvoir asked.
"For evidence."
"Don't give me that crap," said Beauvoir. "You leaked it, and now that you're caught, you're bullshitting.
Why would I leak it?"
"Because—"
"Why?"
roared Francois, his face red with anger.
"Because—"
But Beauvoir didn't know why. Why would the chief superintendent of the Sûreté release a tape of his own agent being killed? It didn't make sense. But Beauvoir knew there was a reason, somewhere. I don't know, Beauvoir admitted. And I don't have to know why. I just know you did it.
Fucking great detective. You don't need evidence? Don't need motive? You just accuse and condemn? Is that what Gamache taught you? I'm not surprised.
Francais looked at Beauvoir as though at something profoundly, spectacularly stupid.
One of us here leaked that tape.
Beauvoir's eyes widened, and his mouth all but fell open.
You can't be serious.
His arms dropped to his sides, and all thought of attack vanished in the face of Francais's words.
Are you saying Chief Inspector Gamache leaked the tape?
Who else benefited?
Benefited?
Beauvoir whispered, shock muting his voice.
He almost died in the attacks. Those were his agents. He hired them, mentored them. He'd die, but he didn't, did he?
I saw that tape. I know every frame. I saw the raw tape, too, even more telling.
What are you saying? Is Gamache investigating the leak of the video?
Francais demanded. Beauvoir was silent.
Is he?
Francais didn't just shout now. He screamed at Beauvoir.
I thought not, said Francais at last, his voice quiet now.
Why would he? He knows who released it. He wants all questions to die away.
You're wrong.
Beauvoir was confused and angry. This man had gotten him twisted around so that up was down and down was up, and nothing made sense. Francais sounded like his grandfather, but said terrible things.
The superintendent lowered his gun completely, then looked at it as though wondering how it got into his hand. He replaced it in the leather holster attached to his belt.
I know you admire him, he said quietly, but Armand Gamache isn't the man you think he is. He made a hatchet job of that rescue. 4 Sûreté agents were killed. You yourself almost died. You were left to bleed to death on the floor. The man you so respect and admire led you in there, then left you to die. I see it every time I watch the tape. He even kissed you goodbye, like Judas.
A Francais's voice was calm, reasonable, comforting, familiar.
He had no choice.
Beauvoir's voice was hoarse. There was nothing left, no impetus forward. He wouldn't attack Francais now. Wouldn't smash a rock into his temple. Beauvoir hadn't the energy left. All he wanted to do was sag to the ground, to sit on the jagged shore and let the mist swallow him up.
Oh, we all have a choice, said Francois. Oh, why release that video? We both know what a mess that raid was. 4 young agents died. That can't be considered a success by any standard.
Lives were saved, said Beauvoir,
though he barely had the energy to speak.
Hundreds of thousands of lives, because of the chief. The deaths weren't his fault. He was given the wrong information.
He was in charge. It was his responsibility. And after all that mess, who comes out a hero? Because of the tape. It could have been edited anyway, to show anything. To show the truth.
Then why did it make Gamache look so good?
That wasn't his doing.
Well, it sure wasn't mine. I know what really happened. And so do you.
Francois's eyes held Beauvoir's.
God help me. I was even forced to give the man a medal of bravery, so strong was public sentiment. Makes me sick just thinking about it.
He didn't want it, said Beauvoir. He hated the whole thing.
Then why did he accept it?
We have a choice, Jean-Guy. We really do.
He deserved that medal, said Beauvoir. He saved more lives than...
He killed?
Yes, perhaps. But he didn't save you.
He could have, but he ran off.
You know it. I know it. He knows it.
He had to.
Yes, I know. He had no choice.
Francois examined Beauvoir, apparently trying to make up his mind about something.
He probably likes you. Like he likes his cat or a nice suit. You suit him. You're useful.
Francois paused.
But that's all.
His voice was soft, reasonable.
You'll never be his friend. You'll never be anything other than a convenient subordinate.
He has you over to his home, treats you like a son, but then he leaves you to die. Don't be fooled, Inspector. You'll never be a member of his family. He comes from Outremont. Where are you from? East End, Montreal, right? Balconville? He went to Cambridge and Université Laval. You went to some grungy public school and played shinny on the streets. He quotes poetry, and you don't understand it, do you? There was a gentleness in his tone. A lot of what he says you don't understand. Am I right? Despite himself, Beauvoir nodded. Neither do I, said Francois, with a small smile. I know after that raid you separated from your wife. I'm sorry to be so personal, but I wondered... Francois's voice petered out, and he looked almost bashful. Then he met Beauvoir's eyes and held them for a moment. I wondered if you were in a new relationship. On seeing Beauvoir's reaction, Francois held up his hand. I know, it's none of my business. But still he held Beauvoir's eyes, and now he lowered his voice still further. Be careful. You're a good officer. I think you can be a great officer if given a chance. If you can just get out on your own. I've seen you texting and making sure the chief didn't see. Now there was a long silence between them. Is it Annie Gamache? The silence was complete. Not a bird called, not a leaf quivered, not a wave came to shore. The world disappeared, and all that was left were two men and a question. Finally, Francois sighed. I hope I'm wrong. He walked back to the door, took out the iron knocker, and hit. It opened. But Beauvoir saw none of this. He turned his back on Saint-Gilbert-Entre-les-Loups and looked out across where the tranquil lake would be if it hadn't disappeared into the mist. Jean-Guy Beauvoir's world was upside down. The clouds had descended, and the sky had become slate. And the only familiar thing was the ache too deep to grasp. Chapter 26. Why did you hide the murder weapon? Gamache asked. And why didn't you tell us about the prior's last words? Frère Simon dropped his eyes to the stone floor of the abbot's rooms, then lifted them again. I think you can guess.
I can always guess, mon frère, said the chief. What I need from you is the truth.
Gamache looked around. They'd returned to the privacy of the abbot's offices. The weak sun no longer lit the room, and his secretary had been too distracted to turn on the lamps, or to even notice they were needed.
Can we speak in the garden? Gamache asked, and Frère Simon nodded.
He seemed to have run out of words, as though he was allocated only so many, and he'd used enough for a lifetime. But it was his actions that were being called to account now. The two men walked through the bookcase, filled with volumes on early Christian mystics, like Julian of Norwich, Hildegard of Bingen, and the writings of other great Christian minds, from Erasmus to C.S. Lewis, filled with books on prayer and meditation, on leading a spiritual life, on leading a Catholic life. They swung aside the words and walked into the world. The hills outside the wall were thick with low-hanging clouds. Mist was sitting on the trees and among the trees, turning the world from the brilliant colours of that morning to shades of grey. Far from diminishing the beauty, it seemed to add to it, giving the world a degree of softness and subtlety, of comfort and intimacy. Wrapped in a towel in the chief's hand was the length of iron that, like a magic wand, had turned the living prior into a dead body. Frère Simon walked to the centre of the garden and paused under the huge, nearly bare maple tree.
"Why didn't you tell us that the prior spoke to you?" said Gamache.
"Because his words were in the form of a confession. My sort, not yours. It was my moral obligation."
"You have convenient morals, mon frère. They seem to allow lying."
That brought Frère Simon up short, and again he reverted to silence. He also, thought Gamache, has a convenient vow of silence.
Why didn't you tell us the prior had said homo just before he died?
Because I knew it had been misunderstood.
Because we're stupid, you mean?
not given to the nuance of mind so obvious in Les Religieux.
Why did you hide the murder weapon?
I didn't hide it. It was in plain sight.
Enough of this, snapped Gamache. I know you're frightened. I know you're cornered. Stop playing these games and tell me the truth, and let's end this. Have the decency and courage to do that. And trust us. We're not the fools you're afraid we are.
Désolé, said the monk with a sigh. I've been trying so hard to convince myself what I did wasn't wrong, I almost forgot that it was. I'm sorry. I should have told you. And God knows, I should never have taken the knocker away.
Why did you?
Frère Simon stared into Gamache's eyes.
You suspect someone, don't you?
Said the chief, holding that stare. The monk's eyes held a plea, a desperate plea for this interrogation to stop, for the questions to stop. But they both knew it couldn't. This conversation was destined to happen, from the moment the blow fell and Frère Simon heard a dying man's last words and took the murder weapon. He knew, one way or another, he'd have to answer for his actions.
"Who do you think did this?" Gamache asked.
"I can't tell you. I can't say the words." And he looked as though, physically, he couldn't.
"We'll stand here for eternity, then, mon frère," said Gamache. "Until you say the words. And then we'll both be free."
"But not..."
"The man you suspect?"
Gamache's eyes and voice softened.
"You think I don't know?"
"Then why force me to say it?" The monk was almost in tears.
"Because you must. It's your burden, not mine."
He looked at Frère Simon with sympathy, as one brother to another.
"Believe me, I have my own."
Simon paused and looked at Gamache.
"Oui, c'est la vérité."
He took a breath. "I didn't tell you that the prior said homo just before he died. Then I hid the murder weapon, because I was afraid the abbot had done it. I thought Dom Philippe had killed Frère Mathieu."
"Merci," said Gamache. "And do you still think that?"
"I don't know what to think. I don't know what else to think."
The chief nodded. He didn't know if Frère Simon was telling the truth, but he did know these words had cost the monk. Simon had, in effect, thrown the abbot to the Inquisition. The question Gamache asked himself now, that the Inquisitors had failed to ask, was whether this was the truth. Or was this poor man so terrified he'd say anything? Did Frère Simon name the abbot to save himself? Gamache didn't know. What he did know was that Frère Simon, the taciturn monk, had loved the abbot, still did. "Will no one rid me of this troublesome priest?" Had Frère Simon rid the abbot of the troublesome prior? Had he taken some subtle look, a raised brow, a twitch of the hand, as a plea from the abbot, and acted upon it? And now, consumed with guilt and flailed by his conscience, was Frère Simon trying to blame the abbot himself? The prior might have been troublesome, but it was nothing compared to an aroused conscience, or the trouble created when the head of homicide knocked at the door. The monk's external lives in Saint-Gilbert might be simple, ruled by the bell and the chance and the changing seasons, but their internal life was a quagmire of emotions. Emotions, Gamache knew, from years of kneeling beside corpses, were what made the body. Not a gun, not a knife, not a length of old iron. Some emotion had slipped the leash and killed Frère Mathieu. And to find his killer, Armand Gamache needed to use his logic, but also his own feelings. The abbot had said, "Why didn't I see this coming?" The question had seemed genuine. The angst certainly was. He hadn't seen that one of his community, his flock, wasn't a sheep at all, but a wolf. But suppose the question, filled with wonder and shock, wasn't aimed at one of the brothers. Maybe the abbot was asking it of himself. "Why didn't I see this coming?" Not the murderous thoughts and actions of another, but of himself. Maybe Dom Philippe was amazed that he himself could, and did, kill. The chief inspector took half a step back. Physically, not much, but it was a signal to the monk that he had a little space and time to compose himself,
to gather himself and his wits back up. It might have been a mistake, the chief knew, to give Frère Simon this time. His colleagues, including Jean-Guy, would almost certainly have pressed on. Knowing the man was on his knees, they'd have forced him to the ground. But Gamache knew that while that sort of thing might be effective in the short term, a man humiliated, emotionally raped, would never again open up. Besides, while Gamache wanted very much to solve the crime, he didn't want to lose his soul in the process. He suspected there were enough lost souls already.
"Why would Dom Philippe kill the prior?" Gamache eventually asked.
The garden was quiet, all sound muffled by the mist. Not that there was much sound to begin with. Birds called every now and then. Chipmunks and squirrels chattered at each other. Twigs and branches broke as something larger moved through the thick Canadian forest. All muffled now.
"You were right about the rift," said Frère Simon. "As soon as that first recording was a success, things started falling apart. Ego, I suspect, and power. Suddenly there was something worth fighting over. Up until then we were all equal, just sort of meandering through our days in a rickety old monastery. We were quite happy, certainly content. But the recording brought so much attention and so much money so quickly." The monk raised the palms to the grey sky and gave a little shrug. "The abbot wanted us to take it slowly, to not rush off and leave our vows behind. But the prior and others saw the success as a sign from God, that we needed to be out in the world more, to share our gifts."
"Each claimed to know God's will," said the chief.
"We were having some difficulty interpreting it," Frère Simon admitted with a small smile.
"Perhaps not the first religieux to have that problem."
"You think?" It was as Gamache had heard from everyone except the abbot. Before the recording, the monastery was falling apart, but the congregation was solid. After the recording, the monastery was being repaired, but the congregation was falling apart. "Some malady is coming upon us." The abbot was stuck trying to figure out the will of a god who seemed himself conflicted.
"The abbot and his prior were good friends, even loving friends, before the recording."
The monk nodded. Gamache thought the Gilbertine could begin a new calendar. There was BR, before the recording, and AR. "Some malady is coming upon us, disguised as a miracle." They were now roughly 18 months AR, plenty of time for a close friendship to turn to hate, as only a good friendship could. The conduit to the heart was already created.
"And a piece of paper?" Gamache asked, indicating the yellowed chant he still held. "What part could this have played?"
Frère Simon thought about that, as did Gamache. The two men stood in the garden as the mist slipped over the wall. "The abbot loves plain chant," said Frère Simon, speaking slowly, working his way through this. "And he has a wonderful voice, very clear, very true. But he isn't the most gifted musician in Saint-Gilbert, and he isn't fluent in Latin. Like the rest of us, he knows Scripture and the Latin Mass, but beyond that, he wasn't a Latin scholar. You might have noticed all his books are in French, not Latin." Gamache had noticed. "I doubt he'd know the Latin word for banana, for instance." Simon pointed to that silly phrase.
"But you did," said Gamache.
"I looked it up."
"As could the abbot."
"But why would he look up and use a string of nonsense words in Latin?" asked Frère Simon. "If he was going to put Latin words on paper, he'd probably use bits of prayers or chants. I doubt he was Gilbert to the Prior Sullivan, or the other way around." Gamache nodded. That had been his reasoning as well. He could see the abbot braining the prior in a fit of passion, not sexual passion, but a much more dangerous kind. A religious fervour, believing Frère Mathieu was going to kill the monastery, kill the order, and it was Dom Philippe's burden, given by God, to stop him. It was also Dom Philippe's job, as father to his sons, to protect them, and that meant protecting their home, defending their home. Gamache had looked into the eyes of too many grieving fathers not to know the force of that love.
He felt it himself, for his own son and daughter. He felt it, God help him, for his agent. He recruited them, chose them, trained them. They were his sons and daughters, and every day he sent them after murderers. And he'd crawled over to each and every mortally wounded one, and held them, and whispered an urgent prayer. Take this child. As gunshots exploded into walls and floors, he'd held Jean-Guy, protecting him with his own body. He'd kissed his brow and whispered those words, too, believing this boy he loved was dying. And he could see in Jean-Guy's eyes he believed it, too. And then he'd left him, to help the others. Gamache had killed that day, coolly taken aim and seen men lose their lives. He'd kill deliberately, and he'd do it again, to save his agent. Armand Gamache knew the power of a father's love, whether it be a biological father or a father by choice and fate. If he could kill, why couldn't the abbot? But Gamache couldn't, for the life of him, see what role the Neumes might have played. It all made sense, except for the mystery he held in his hand. Like a father himself, the prior had died hugging it. The chief inspector left Frère Simon and went in search of Beauvoir, to bring him up to speed and to give him the murder weapon for safekeeping. Gamache doubted the iron knocker had much to tell them. Frère Simon had admitted washing it off, scrubbing it down, and replacing it by the door, so that anyone wanting admittance to the abbot's locked rooms yesterday morning would put their fingerprints and DNA on it. And many had, including Gamache himself. The prior's office was empty. A few monks were working in the animalerie, feeding and cleaning the goats and chickens. Down the other corridor, Gamache looked in the dining hall and then opened the door to the chocolaterie. "Looking for someone?" Frère Charles asked. "Inspector Beauvoir." "I'm afraid he isn't here." The medical monk put a scoop into the vat of melted chocolate and brought out a ladle filled with dripping blueberries. "Last batch of the day, picked by Frère Bernard this morning. He had to go out twice, poor man. Apparently he ate the first harvest himself." Frère Charles laughed. "An occupational hazard. Like some?" He gestured to the long rows of tiny, dark brown spheres, already cooled and ready to be packaged and shipped south. Gamache, feeling a bit like a child playing hooky, walked into the chocolaterie and closed the door. "Please." Frère Charles motioned to a sturdy stool and pulled one up himself. "We take shifts working here. When the monks first started making chocolate-covered berries, one monk was assigned to work. But then they noticed he was getting larger and the output was shrinking." Gamache smiled and took the confection the monk was offering. "Merci." If possible, the wildly flavorful berry covered in the musky chocolate was even tastier than before. Now, if a monk was murdered for these, Gamache could understand. But then, he thought, taking another chocolate, we all have our drug of choice. For some it's chocolate, for others it's chance. "You told Inspector Beauvoir that you were neutral in the conflict within the monastery, mon frère. A sort of Red Cross, ministering to the wounded in the battle for control of Saint-Gilbert. Who would you say were the most hurt by the fighting, but also by the prior's death?" "In the fighting, I'd say not a man was left untouched. We all felt horrible about what was happening, but no one quite knew how to stop it. So much seemed at stake, and there didn't seem to be any middle ground. You couldn't make half a recording or remove half the vow of silence. There didn't seem a compromise possible."
"You say there was so much at stake. Do you know about the foundations?"
"What foundations? Of the abbey?"
Gamache nodded, watching the cheerful doctor closely.
"What about them? Do you know if they're solid?" asked Gamache. "Are you talking literally or figuratively?"
"Literally, nothing could knock these walls down. The original monks knew what they were doing. But figuratively, I'm afraid Saint-Gilbert is very shaky."
"Merci," said Gamache. Here was another who didn't seem to know anything about cracked foundations. Was it possible Frère Raymond was wrong, or lying? Did he make the whole thing up to help pressure the abbot into the second recording?
"And after the prior's death, mon frère,
Which of the monks was most upset?
Well, we were all devastated. Even those brothers who bitterly opposed him were shocked.
Bien sûr, said the chief, shaking his head and refusing more chocolate. If he didn't stop now, he'd eat them all.
But can you separate them out? The community here isn't amorphous. You might sing with a single voice, but you don't react with a single emotion.
True. The doctor sat back and thought about that for a moment. I'd say two people were the most upset. Frère Luc, he's the youngest of us, the most impressionable, and the least connected to the community. His only connection seems to be the choir. And, of course, Frère Mathieu was the choir master. He adored Frère Mathieu. He was a big reason Luc joined the little old Gilbertine, to study under the prior and to sing the Gregorian chants.
Are the chants here that different? Dom Philippe says every monastery sings from the same book of plain chant.
True, but strangely enough they sound different here. I don't know why. Maybe it's the prior, or the acoustics, or the specific combination of voices.
I understand Frère Luc has a beautiful voice.
He does. Technically the best of all of us, by far.
But...
Oh, he'll get there. Once he learns to channel those emotions from his head and into his heart. One day he'll be the choir master himself, and he'll be a magnificent one. He has all the passion. He just needs to direct it.
But will he stay?
The medical monk absently ate a few more blueberries. And now that Frère Mathieu is dead? I don't know. Perhaps not. It was a huge loss to the whole community, but perhaps to Frère Luc most of all. I think there was some hero worship there, not unusual in a mentor-pupil relationship.
Was the prior Frère Luc's mentor?
He mentored all of us, but since Luc was the newest, he needed the most guidance.
Could Frère Luc have misread their relationship? Assumed it was more special? Unique, even?
In what way? Frère Charles, while still cordial, was now guarded. They all became defensive when there was any suggestion of a special friendship.
Could he have thought the choir director was grooming him? That this was more than simply schooling him in the ways of this particular choir?
It's possible, admitted Frère Charles, but the prior would have been sensitive to that and stopped it. Frère Luc wouldn't have been the first monk to fall under his spell.
Had Frère Antoine, the soloist? Asked Gamache. They must have been close.
You're not suggesting Frère Antoine killed the prior in some fit of jealousy when the prior turned his attention to Luc? The doctor all but snorted. But Gamache knew laughter often covered up an uncomfortable truth.
Is it so ludicrous? Asked the chief.
The smile fell from the monk's face. You mistake us for the cast of some soap opera. Frère Antoine and Mathieu were colleagues. They shared a love of Gregorian chant. That is the only love they shared.
But that was quite a potent love, wouldn't you say? Asked Gamache. All-consuming, even.
The doctor remained silent now, just watching the chief. Not agreeing, but not disagreeing either.
You said there were two people most affected by the prior's death.
Gamache broke the silence.
One was Luc. Who was the other?
The abbot. He's trying to hold it together, but I can see what a strain it is. There are small signs, a slight inattention, forgetting things. His appetite is off. I've ordered him to eat more. It's always the small things that give us away, isn't it?
Brother Charles dropped his gaze to the chief inspector's hands, one lightly clasping the other.
Are you all right?
Me? Asked Gamache, surprised.
The doctor brought his hand up and grazed his finger along his left temple.
Ah, said the chief, that. You noticed.
I'm a medical man, said Brother Charles with a smile. I almost never miss a deep scar on the temple. Then his face grew serious, or a trembling hand.
An old issue, said Gamache, in the past.
A bleed? Asked the doctor, not letting it go.
A bullet, said the chief.
Oh, said Brother Charles, a hematoma. Is that the only effect, the tremble in your right hand? Gamache didn't quite know how to answer that, so he didn't. Instead he smiled and nodded.
It gets slightly more noticeable when I'm tired or stressed.
Yes, Inspector Beauvoir told me.
Did he?
Gamache looked interested, and not particularly pleased. I asked. The doctor looked at Gamache for a moment, examining him, seeing the friendly face, the lines from the corners of his eyes and his mouth, laugh lines. Here was a man who knew how to smile. But there were other lines, too, on his forehead and between Gamache's brows, lines that came with worry. But more than this man's physical body, what struck Frère Charles about Gamache was his calm. Frère Charles knew this was the sort of peace a person found only after being at war. "If that's your only symptom, you're a lucky man," the medical monk finally said.
"Yes.
Take this child. Though the arrival of your boss doesn't seem to have improved the situation." Gamache said nothing. Not for the first time, he realized these monks missed very little. Every breath, every look, every movement, every tremble told these monks something. This medical monk in particular.
"It was a surprise," Gamache admitted.
"Who do you think killed the prior?" "Changing the subject?" The doctor smiled, then thought before he answered. "I honestly don't know. I've thought of little else since his death. I can't believe any of us did it, but of course one of us did." He paused again and looked directly at Gamache. "One thing I know for sure, though."
"What's that?"
"Most people don't die at once." It wasn't what Gamache was expecting the doctor to say, and he wondered if Brother Charles realized the prior was alive when Frère Simon found him. "They die a bit at a time," said the doctor.
"Excusez-moi?"
"They don't teach this at medical school, but I've seen it in real life. People die in bits and pieces. A series of petites morts, little deaths. They lose their sight, their hearing, their independence. Those are the physical ones. But there are others, less obvious but more fatal. They lose heart, they lose hope, they lose faith, they lose interest, and finally, they lose themselves."
"What are you telling me, Frère Charles?"
"That it's possible both the prior and his killer were well down the same path. Both might have suffered a series of petite morts before the final blow."
"The grand mort," said Gamache. "And who here fits that description?"
Now the doctor leaned forward, past the field of chocolate blueberries. "How do you think we get here, Chief Inspector? To Saint-Gilbert-entre-les-Loups? We didn't follow the yellow brick road. We were shoved along by our own petite mort. There isn't a man in this monastery who didn't come through that door wounded, damaged, almost dead inside."
"And here you found what?"
"Healing. Our wounds were bound. The holes inside us were filled with faith. Our loneliness healed by the company of God. We thrived on simple work and healthy food, on routine and certainty, by no longer being alone. But more than anything, it's the joy of singing to God. The chance saved us, Chief Inspector. Plain chance. They resurrected each and every one of us."
"Well, maybe not all of you."
Both men sat with the knowledge that the miracle hadn't been perfect. One man was missed.
"Eventually those chants destroyed your community."
"I can see how it would appear that way, but the chants weren't the problem. It was our own egos, power struggles. It was terrible."
"Some malady is coming upon us," said Gamache.
The doctor looked puzzled, then nodded, placing the quote. "T.S. Eliot, Murder in the Cathedral.
Oui.
That's it. A malady," said the medical monk. Gamache, as he made his way out the door, was left to wonder just how neutral this Red Cross really was. Had the good doctor found the malady and cured it with a blow to the head? Jean-Guy Beauvoir re-entered the monastery and went in search of one private place, just some place he could be alone. Finally he found it, the narrow walkway running above and around the blessed chapel. Beauvoir climbed the winding steps and sat on the narrow stone bench carved into the wall. He could stay there without being seen. Once sitting, though, he felt he might never get up.
they'd find him decades from now, ossified, turned to rock up there, a gargoyle, perched and permanently looking down on the bowing and genuflecting men in black and white. Beauvoir longed at that moment to slip into a robe, to shave his head, to tighten the cord around his waist, and see the world in black and white. Gamache was good, Francois was bad. Annie loved him, he loved Annie. The Gamaches would accept him as their son, as their son-in-law. They'd be happy, he and Annie would be happy. Simple, clear. Beauvoir closed his eyes and took deep breaths, smelling the incense. Years and years of it. Instead of bringing up bad memories of hours wasted on hard pews, it actually smelt good. Comforting. Relaxing. Deep breath in. Deep breath out. In his hand, he clasped a pill bottle he'd found on the table in his cell, a note scribbled beside it. Take as needed. The signature was illegible, but it looked like Frère Charles's. He was a doctor, after all, thought Beauvoir. There could be no harm. He'd stood in his cell, uncertain. The familiar bottle rested in his hand, as though the small cavity in the center of his fist was designed for it. He knew what the bottle contained, even without reading the label. But he read it anyway, and felt both alarm and relief. Oxycontin. Beauvoir was tempted to bolt down a pill right then and there, in his cell, then lie down on the narrow cot, and feel the warmth spread and the pain ebb. But he was afraid Gamache might walk in. Instead, he found a place he suspected the chief, afraid of heights, wouldn't go, even if he knew it was there. The exposed catwalk above the Blessed Chapel. Now Beauvoir looked at the bottle in his hand, clasped so tightly the cap had left a purple circle in his palm. It was, after all, from a doctor. And he was in pain. "Oh, Christ," he whispered, and opened the bottle. A few moments later, in the Blessed Chapel, Jean-Guy Beauvoir found blessed relief. The bells of Saint-Gilbert rang out, not the thin call to prayers of earlier in the day, but all the bells pealed in a hearty, robust, full-bodied invitation. Chief Inspector Gamache looked at his watch, out of habit, but he knew what the bell signalled. 5 o'clock service. Vespers. The Blessed Chapel was empty when he slid into a pew. He put the murder weapon on the seat beside him and closed his eyes. But not for long. Someone had joined him in the pew.
Salut, mon vieux, said Gamache. Where have you been? I was looking for you.
He'd known it was Jean-Guy without looking. Here and there, said Beauvoir. Investigating a murder, you know.
Are you all right? Gamache asked.
Beauvoir seemed dazed, and his clothes were disheveled. Fine. I went for a walk and slipped on the path outside. I need to get out every now and then.
I know what you mean,